So I can get some scotch tape then, all right?
Yeah.
Testing, testing.
Last week.
Uh-huh.
This category is jokes. I'm Susie Sharon. I'm going to tell a knock-knock joke. Knock-knock.
Who's there?
Banana.
Banana who?
Banana, banana. Knock-knock.
Who's there?
Banana.
Banana who?
Banana, banana. Knock-knock.
Who's there?
Orange. Aren't you glad I didn't say banana again?
Yeah.
My name's Shari Mason. I'm going to tell you a joke. There was a fire in a house. Why was the mother and the father and the baby living?
I don't know.
Because the mother was eating Lifesavers, the father was in the living room, the baby was wearing safety pins.
My name is Thomas Brown. The teacher said, who's the speaker of the house?
I don't know.
My mother. This is another one. The professor's saying to the student, name two pronouns. Who, me? Nobody laughs!
I'm Arnold Drone, and I'm going to tell you two jokes. Show me a mule that's flunked out of school, and I'll show you a flunky donkey. Before you hang your clothes, make sure they have a fair trial.
All right, my name's Jonathan Baird, and I got this joke. Junior, wait a minute. Oh yeah, what happens to a ball player's eyes when they begin to fail?
I don't know.
They make an umpire out of him.
This category is riddles.
My name's Andrea Frank. What would you do if you were locked in a house with just a mirror and a table?
I don't know.
You would look in the mirror and see what you saw and take the saw and cut the table in half and put it together again so it's a hole and go through the hole.
The next category is elephant jokes. This is one of the oldest. Why do elephants wear green sneakers?
I don't know.
To hide in the grass. What is yellow and then green and then yellow and then green?
I don't know.
A banana who works at night is a pickle.
How do you fit six elephants in a Volkswagen?
I don't know.
Three in the front and three in the back.
How do you know when an elephant's been in the refrigerator?
I don't know.
You see his footprints in the cheesecake.
Why did the elephant paint his toenails all different colors?
I don't know.
To hide in the M&M's pack.
M&M's pack.
How do you catch an elephant with a pair of binoculars, tweezers, and a little box?
I don't know.
You turn the binoculars upside down, turn around, and he looks small, and you pick him up with the tweezers and put him in a little box.
How do you know if there's an elephant in your pocket?
I don't know.
You'll hear something munching at your peanuts.
Why did the elephant paint his toenails purple?
I don't know.
To hide in the grave.
How do you catch an elephant?
I don't know.
Take some paint, a sign, a tweezers, a jar, and a field glass. You look through the field glass backwards. Who did that?
What's purple and conquered half of the world?
I don't know.
Alexander the Great.
Which gray has a big trunk, a tail?
The next category is tongue twisters.
My name is Shari Mason, and I'm going to tell you a tongue twister. Unique New York. Can you say that three times fast?
Unique New York. Unique New York. Unique New York.
Then there's toy boat. Can you say that three times fast?
Toy boat, toy boat, toy boat.
And there's she sells by the seashore.
She sells by the seashore. She sells, forget it.
Pamela Casper, and I'm going to tell you a tongue twister. How much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? As much wood as a woodchuck could if a woodchuck could chuck wood.
One smart man, he felt smart. Two smart men, they felt smart. Three smart men, they all felt smart. Say that.
One smart man, he felt smart. Felt smart. Three smart men, they all felt smart.
This is Heidegger said, try strange strategic statistics.
I can't do it.
Strange strategic statistics.
Forget it.
This is Esther Robinson. Can you say a box of biscuits, a box of mixed biscuits, and biscuit mixer?
No.
This is Pablo Leprell. Can you say, does a doctor, according to the doctor, doctor's doctoring of doctoring, or does the doctor doing the doctoring, doctor the other doctor according to his own doctoring?
I can't even remember it.
Here's counting out rhymes.
Okay, I'm David Coffey, and this is a counting rhyme for choosing up for tag. Doggy, doggy, step right out. And here's another one. Mickey Mouse built a house. How many bricks did he use? Person's age. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And you are not it.
Next we have limericks.
This is Peter Warnton. This is a limerick about school. Try all of them. D.A., we have a school today. The teacher passed away. We killed it yesterday.
I'm not sure if this is a limerick. Whenever you see a hearse go by, remember the day you're going to die. They wrap you up in a big white sheet. They send you down about 10 feet deep. The worms go in, the worms go out. They chew your guts and they spit them up. The one who's not shy at all goes in your ear and out your eye. Your stomach turns a slimy green, and it turns out like sour cream. You slap it on a piece of bread, and that's what you eat when you are dead. Pray for the dead, and the dead will pray for you. Break your mother's back. Step on a line, break your father's spine. Step in a hole, break your mother's sugar bowl. God made the oceans. God made the lakes. God made you. We all make mistakes. Now I lay me down to rest. If I die before I wake, that's one less test I'll have to take.
This is a superstition. When the moon's full and the sun's still up, run home with your eyes closed, or the devil will get you.
This is a teasing. My name is Pamela Casper, and I'm going to give you something about teasing. Baby, 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 stick your head in gravy, wash it off with bubble gum and send it to the Navy.
La, la, la.
Yeah, this is Susan Chambers, and, hit me, I won't hit you back. I'll hit you front.
My name's Peter Wunsch. I'm going to do some teasing. What's your name? John Brown. Ask me again. I'll knock you down.
Hello? This is David Turner. Your father is so old, he is growing hair between his teeth.
Your mother is crazy. Your father is so old, he's a legend. Your grandmother is so old, she squeaks when she walks. Your sister is so skinny, she can dodge raindrops standing still. Let me see. Your mother is so fat, she needs a crowbar and shoehorn to get fit in a bathtub.
I'm rubber, you're glue, whatever you say bounces. Wait a minute. I'm rubber, you're glue, whatever you say bounces off me and sticks to you.
You're so low, you're like a serpent. And, let me do that again. No. thinking of two or three of them now. All right. Never mind.
You are so small. You are so small that you can sit on a curb and swing your legs.
No, I have it now. You're so low down that it would take a stepladder for you to tickle a snake's belly.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, what you say is what you are.
You are so skinny that you can slide down a razor blade without getting cut.
The next thing is retort.
Shut up.
Make me.
I don't make monkeys.
Then don't make yourself.
How stupid do you think I am? I don't know. How stupid?
You're a nut. A nut is from a tree. A tree is from nature. Nature is beautiful. Thanks for the compliment.
You are so small you can sit on a penny and tell if it's heads or tails. Not so funny.
You're a jerk. A jerk is a Yank. A jerk is a Yank. A Yank is a good American. Thanks for the compliment.
The next is autographs.
Don't worry if your job is small and your rewards are few. Remember that the mighty oak was once a nut like you.
This is Pablo LaPrell. You can always tell the English. You can always tell the Dutch. You can always tell the Yankees, but you can't tell them much.
This is Heidi Gerstad. Last night upon a stake, I saw a man who was not there. He was not there again today. My God, I wish he'd go away.
My name is Pamela Casper.
Beware of boys with eyes of brown that kiss you once and turn you down. Beware of boys with eyes of blue that kiss you once and ask for two. Beware of boys with eyes of gray that kiss you once and turn away. Beware of boys with eyes of black that kiss you once and never come back. You will know all kinds of joys if you'll only beware of boys.
Roses are red, violets are blue. Sugar is sweet, and so are you.
All right. Roses are red, violets are blue. Cornbread is corny, and so are you.
Roses are red, violets are blue. You belong... Something about that. Something about...
You look like a monkey.
You look like a monkey and you belong in the zoo. Pop,
pop, pop, pop, pop, pop, pop. This is a story, not an autograph.
This is the last one.
This is a traditional story.
Louder. When my father and mother got married, it was a tradition that they'd go over to my great-grandmother's, who was about 90 then, and they'd have dinner with my grandparents and my great-grandparents. And so whenever they went over, or rather when my mother went over by herself, when she wasn't married, they'd have a big meal, and it was an Italian family, and they'd get all drunk with wine.
The drunks!
Well, the television set kept going. We stayed for about 20 minutes, and we laughed, and the question was, we'd better try. There were three more families, and things might get better. But they didn't get better, and in the fourth home, I was desperate, and I didn't know what to do, and we were standing there very awkwardly, so I just sat down on the floor and told this woman, who was the mother of this little girl, that I was really very sorry about all of this, and that I really didn't know what to say to her. That I tried saying other things to the other families, and I just didn't seem to be making any contact, but that I really would like to find out how her daughter was getting along, and I had by this time given up the whole concept of psychiatry, people anyway, and perhaps as a result of my work, it turns into a comprehensive meeting. But anyway, I had given up the concept of psychiatry, and I told him that I was a doctor and I really wanted to be of some help, and she looked at me and she said that she was going to pray for me. I told her that I was very grateful for that and thought that I needed it, and it seemed the warmest. We seemed to be having the best time. And when I left, I did something that was the most psychiatric moment we'd had in New Orleans up until this time, in the sense that I left my I'd taken my jacket off and I left it there. And that was a nice, very good slip of forgetfulness. And she came after and brought it to us as we were leaving. So that was the beginning of our relationship with these four families. Of course, over a period of months, the hazards were in the other direction, namely a kind of hospitality that at times threatened to make me a little fat. But we had an interesting time, and of course what I'm trying to convey to you is how perhaps an earnest, well-intentioned, if I may say so, middle-class New Englander psychiatrist trying to do good comes into contact with people who just don't know what the devil he's doing there and what it's all about, and are very suspicious and very frightened, and how hard it is even for this person who is an expert in fear to be aware of just how frightened they are or were, and how frightened he is. Because if I had been totally aware of how frightened I was, I suppose I never would have done this. So we have to deny things at times in a very healthy and nice way so that we can go on with our work. In Atlanta, the next year, they started high school desegregation, so I, by now, was doing very good. Now I had another sample of another age group. I was slowly chucking away my methodological preoccupations and concentrating my attentions on simply the experience of getting to know these families. But we did move up to Atlanta because I thought this is another state in another area, and I would find out how these 10 children who went into four high schools in that city would manage. I was a little more adept by this time. The first home we went to was in a very secluded neighborhood, and I knew that they were literally, you know, focusing guns on us because they were very frightened. The tension and the threats at that time in the South, and that's only 3 years ago, even in these situations, let alone sit-ins, was something that I hope was a thing of the past. But we could see, and when we made the telephone call, they asked us what kind of car we were coming in, and I knew then. But when we came to the first house in Atlanta, we started to get the same reaction, and we had the feeling that we had accomplished something, because I told them, I said that, I know you want me to get out of here fast, but I'm really going to stay, even if I'm just a pain in the neck, and the frankness went well. We also decided to work with white children. What happens to white children in situations like this? In New Orleans, you probably remember, there were several white children out of hundreds who stayed in those schools. Why? In one school, the famous France school, 500 children were pulled out within 2 days. One, two, three parents kept their children in. Two of them were ministers. It wasn't hard to figure out their motivations, reasonably so. But there was one woman who kept four children in, and her children were the majority of the school, because there were the two white children of the other two families, and then there was this one little Negro girl, and then there were these four children, four of nine. This woman had nine children. And she has always intrigued me, because I learned something from her that was, I think, very, not just that experience, but a lot of what's happened in the South, I think, is symbolized by what happened to her. She comes from an old Louisiana family, relatively lower middle class, but nevertheless deeply Southern. She was not an integrationist. In fact, she was opposed to school desegregation, as was her husband. Why were her children in that school, though? And she was risking, in many ways, more than the Negro child, because the mob was bent on boycott more than the Negro child. They wanted white families to stay away from that school, and they were eminently successful in doing so for over an entire school year. This was a fascinating little group in that school, this one child plus six other children, and what happened to them and the teachers, who were also opposed to school desegregation, but who stayed, and why, you might ask. In the case of the teachers, they stayed because they didn't want to lose their jobs. A very powerful motivation in the South or in any area. But Mrs. Connor's reasons were very interesting. I wasn't the only one who was trying to find out about them. There was a sociologist from Princeton there. There was a newspaper reporter. One finds out one's cohorts in this work. And they wanted to know why. And they came and went. We stayed for a couple of years, and we got to know them pretty well. And one day, she was very concerned about what I thought about her children, apart from the school desegregation thing, but just generally. But one day, we had a long talk, and she explained to me just how this had happened, a little ashamedly. And I thought it was a fascinating story, because what had happened is that she had gone in with all the other parents and was going to take her children out. And she did take them out. She pulled them out from the school, and on the way home, it occurred to her that if she took them home, they would be at home. So she hesitated for a minute. She hesitated for a minute, and she took them back into the back door, thinking, as Southerners have been thinking in many similar situations these past few years, thinking that this won't last. Mobs cannot last, and why not let them stay in school just one more day, and then we'll see what will happen tomorrow. Well, tomorrow came. There were some mobs, and she decided, well, she really didn't think that she ought to risk this. But it occurred to her that, again, tomorrow, that day, that this might be the end, and why not try just one more time? But she wouldn't do it through the front door, so now she took them to school through the back door. And they came to school. They stayed there, and she came and snuck them out. But now she was a little more involved, and furthermore, some of the white liberal people from the Garden District, much more comfortable than her neighborhood, were now involved in trying to break this boycott. And they, of course, focused on her, because hers was the only family that was doing it, and there were four children. So they came and they talked with her. And she was quite flattered and impressed with these people. And she agreed to let it go day by day, and they took her children to school. And this was the beginning of a real commitment on her part. She was appalled at the language she heard, and she became identified, really, with that whole situation. But it was all by accident, and she was always apologetic about it and afraid to talk about it, because now, particularly over the months, she was a kind of a hero to the people in the city that were interested in desegregation. Well, you might say this is a peculiar case, but I don't think it's any more peculiar than what one sees even, for instance, in Atlanta, where there was no boycott. It's these small things that happen, like a ruler is dropped in a corridor, and a child, teenager, picks up the ruler, because that's what we're taught to do as good white Southern Methodists or Baptists. You pick up a ruler when it's dropped. And then you find that the owner of the ruler is someone who's Negro. And suddenly there is a collision of your own immediate experience with what you have also been taught all your life, your values, your ideals. And although we are used to hearing about the more violent and horrible times in the South, I think the thing that has fascinated us, as my wife and me, as we live there now for 5 years, or did live there for 5 years, is the struggle that people have to make coherent their own lives, and how it isn't just a region of hateful people, but a region of people who did not create this system but were born to it, and who have all kinds of mixed feelings that are contradictory, and that given the historical moment of change, such as we've been seeing, then have to make sense of these contradictions in ways sometimes we're rarely challenged to do. I'm back in Boston now, and I've just started trying to do the same thing in Boston that we did in the South, namely I go to school every morning on a bus filled with Negro children that goes to another part of the city where there's an all-white school, or formerly all-white. Now, this is not supported by the Boston School Committee, a school committee which, in my opinion, is worse than anything I've ever seen in either Atlanta or New Orleans. But it's done as a private bus supported by people in the city. And I am struck by what happens to these children as they ride in this bus and what happens to the children at the school where they arrive. But I'm also struck about by the fact that all of the things that we saw in the South and that we thought were so peculiar to that region are very much a part of the problem in the North, and in many ways even more so, because as we all know who are acquainted with the South, the South has a caste system, but it also has, apart from that caste system, there is a tradition of closeness and intimacy, New Orleans having an enormously desegregated area of population. In fact, in the South now, ironically, the progress that one sees in the region is also accompanied by segregation, housing segregation, and so the most progressive parts of the South are the most segregated parts, housing-wise, for instance. And ultimately, this will be school-wise, too. In the North, I think there is the problem of real strangeness and a kind of confusion that the Southerner doesn't have. And in many ways, that may be much more difficult. Because as some of these Southern white children have told me, once they get over the shock of picking up those rulers and get over the shock of the fact that this just isn't done, then they come to realize that it's been done all the time, I mean, in many ways. But I think for it's what I see in Boston, it's a much more fearful and rigid struggle on both sides. Because there is simply no acquaintance. I'm not sure that it's simply the romanticism and the sentimentality of the Southerners when they say that once they have gone through this, that it will be a better time between the races and perhaps in any other section of the country. But I want to get back and tell you perhaps the most interesting thing that happened to me as a professional man working in this problem. I worked at this, and I got involved with the sit-in movement, and have worked with a lot of the sit-in students. And then later got involved with migrant workers, because several of these families that we knew had relatives who had, they'd all left the sharecropper farms, and some of them had come into the city, and others had become migrant workers. And I became intrigued with what happens to people when they move around like this and live this kind of life. I can't go into all of these things, but I want to get back really to this whole business of those little children in New Orleans and older children in Atlanta, because what I was confronted with over a period of months is the fact that I was not finding pathology, that these children were not getting ill, they weren't developing symptoms, they were going through mobs, they were being screamed at, their parents were being threatened, they weren't getting sick. My job is sickness, and to document it, and I was going to present a report, you know, a professional meeting one of these days, and I had and I was looking for this with increasing desperation and annoyance. Why weren't they getting ill? They didn't seem to be specially gifted children. They weren't chosen by any serious process of psychological testing or interviewing. They were just ordinary kids in these cities. We went on a long trip through Arkansas and Tennessee, talking with school teachers, talking with children, trying to find out what's going on here, because here were, you know, children from all over the South in these highly tense situations, singled out, subject to various pressures, and, you know, what was happening to them. And I found very little illness. Amazing adjustment, not only psychologically, but educationally, from children that came from markedly inferior schools, in the case of the high school students, and from what we now call culturally disadvantaged homes, in the case of the young children entering school for the first time. Well, let me tell you the experience that I have, and may explain this to you, did to me. I went to a basketball game with a boy in Atlanta, one of the 10 students, one of the 10 Negro students who pioneered desegregation there. And let me give you an abbreviated clinical history. This boy was born in a sharecropper's cabin in South Carolina. His mother and father came to the city of Atlanta when he was about 6 months old. His father had a job as a kind of superintendent's helper in an apartment house area in Atlanta. They were very, very poor. The father was, by any definition, an alcoholic. The mother had been in the only state hospital in the state of Georgia, a couple of times for what I later learned was a schizophrenic break, a serious mental illness. I won't even describe to you the facilities in the Georgia State Hospital for Negro patients, but in any case, despite those facilities, she managed to get better and come home. And this was one boy of six children. They had no pictures on the walls. They had a transistor radio, very few chairs. Now, what are we going to do with a family like this? How does a child psychiatrist make sense of this kind of family? And here was a boy who had had 10 years of education in a Negro high school in Atlanta. He was not a particularly gifted child, although obviously had done well at the Negro school, and was moved from that school to the first-rate college preparatory high school, Henry Grady High School, in Atlanta. Now, what did he do? He was there for 2 years. He had some academic trouble, but he went over to Atlanta University, he was tutored. He ended up graduating with honors in that school. He didn't develop any symptoms, he didn't have a mental breakdown, and he's now in college. I think that an experience of getting to know a family like this is, I think I learned more in this than I learned in all the years of my psychiatric residency. Because I was utterly perplexed by this, and to some extent still am. Because it's a very chastening experience. We sit around all day in clinical conferences reading about a family history and then saying, well, of course, and tracing the illness to this and to this, and it all makes sense to us retrospectively. But when one sees something like this, one has to become very much aware of the very serious limitations in our profession at this time. We don't know what makes for strength in people. We're much better at knowing what makes for weakness. But we don't know what makes for strength, and we may have explanations that account for it, but I don't think they're valid. I don't think they really do justice to the ambiguity and difficulty in knowing about the nature of human experience. Because this family was not that rare. And getting back to that basketball game, we attended the game, and there was an enormous amount of heckling, so that we were, I thought, unfairly competing with the basketball players. And we left the gymnasium, and Lawrence and I talked for a little while, and then we went home. I drove him home, and I was very angry at those people who had been saying those things to us. And I told him so. And he smiled at me and said, you're always getting angry in situations like that. And, but I was smart because I knew that he was covering up his own anger. And my job, of course, and I thought, well, you know, I've known this boy now for over a year, and I think the time has come for us, like in psychotherapy, to have our confrontation. And let me tell him that I know what he's doing and that he doesn't have to do that with me. So I did. I told him that I thought he was angry too, but that he was simply covering it up. And I have all kinds of fancy words to describe covering it up. Unfortunately, I have those words. But anyway, I told him that, and he said, no, that wasn't the situation. And he said, you know, when I was about 6 or 7 years old, he described to me what had happened to him, how he'd gone to Rich's, which is the equivalent of Macy's here, with his mother, and he had stepped on a little white girl's toes, and the girl had screamed, and there had been an incident in the store. And then what happened, he came home and his mother beat him. Well, Negro parent in the South, of course, being a segregationist, acting to enforce segregation at every turn. He remembered this, and he'd gone through many experiences like that. And he said that therefore, it wasn't new to him to hear these things, that he may be angry, but he really was, it was more that he was used to it. But that now to go and hear this and know that he's going to graduate from Henry Grady High School, and that every shout he heard was going to be one less that his children would hear, and he put this rather eloquently to the point that I would be embarrassed to really say it the way he did. And he's not an ideologue, and he's not really an intellectual, but he had the story there, and what he was really telling me is that he was going through a very difficult situation, but that it made sense, that it was directed toward the undoing of injuries that he had suffered for a long time, and that I simply was unable to feel the way he did because my life was not like his. And I hadn't lived the number of years that he had lived and developed the kind of ways he had developed of dealing with things, and that therefore, I don't think you conceptualize this, but therefore it ill behooves someone like me to take experiences like his and slip them into a kind of language that I have that suits my way of looking at the world and certain people that I'm used to seeing. Well, that was a lot to learn, and that was probably the most I ever learned as a psychiatrist in a situation like this. I had a report a couple years ago that there was an astonishing lack of illness in these children, and try to explain it because that's what I'm always trying to do, explain things. But in order to explain it, I had to call upon things other than my own professional way of looking at things. I had to call upon history, social, changing social system, and particularly history, what it means to live in a historical moment, which I think that psychiatry has got to come to terms with, that we are not only what we were when we were 5 years old, and what happened to us between our mothers and our fathers, God save them, the beating they've taken in our hands over these years, but that we are many things, and that we become many things, and that it isn't just a kind of unidirected emotion from certain specific childhood experiences to a kind of a determined certainty of our lives, but that we can be or not be all kinds of things depending on what happens to us. Because I know that this boy, if it weren't for what happened in Atlanta in 1961, would probably be the delinquent that several of his brothers are, and his mother knows that, she being a much better psychiatrist, I think, than I and many of my colleagues would be, because she understands what a very sophisticated concept that, to my knowledge, only someone like Eric Erickson has done justice to, which is that there are the individual lives in the family, and then with all kinds of possibilities in them, but often not realized, and then there is what happens in the world around us, and how that world around us either brings out or dampens possibilities in all of us. Now, there's plenty of evidence for this, but it doesn't really seem like a very astonishing thing to say. And yet I'm surprised at how well people understand that if a child is hit at 3, it might affect the way he'll be at 20, and how little people understand that what happens to a child at 20 may be more important than what happened to him at 3, and that may well supersede all that's happened to him at 3 and 5. Stress and children. I pick up the papers and I read about how terrible it is for children, for instance, to participate in this or to do that. And we know what we, this country is concerned with children and protecting them, putting them in cellophane bags and protecting them from everything, lest they become hurt and therefore, I gather, impaired people later on. And yet I wonder how many of us realize, you know, I wonder how many of us stop and say, well, what may be a stress to me is not a stress to someone else. In fact, it may be a glorious moment for someone else. So one person's horrible predicament and stress might well be another person's realization. And how do we deal with that in our own field? Well, what we have to deal, the only way we can deal with it, I think, is to be very, very careful about what we do when we generalize from one patient to statements about human beings in general. Well, I've seen, for instance, migrant children. I started studying these migrant children, and I thought, this is a group of people that are probably most exploited and harassed and destroyed human beings in the face of this earth, at least in the face of the American earth. Well, in many ways they are. And yet they have enormous resilience, a stubbornness that enables them to move over the land and at very little reward. And I'm not here to defend or glorify migrant workers, ironic indeed if that were interpreted that way. But I think it's terribly important for us to understand what makes this family work, this migrant family. How do they look at traveling, and how do their children get along with them in such a way that they're able to survive this? Because we know, as we put ourselves into their position, that we would fall apart. Well, the answer is, of course, that their lives have been different, and that it means a different thing to them than it would mean to us. And with that bit of leverage into understanding the predicament, the various predicaments of people, we have to be very cautious when we start making statements like, I think it's terrible for children to participate in racial demonstrations because, after all, they're being injured. And this is not a child struggle. This is a struggle for adults. And at that, it's a rather unfortunate one. I see children participating in racial demonstrations in Alabama, and they're described in the New York Times as 10, 12 years old. What is a child? Even that question is something we have to think about. There are children in this country who are 10 and 12 years old who are getting ready to get married, who have been working since 7 and 8. Now, if they're being hurt by trying to get a little more freedom and the right to vote by being threatened by the police in Camden, Alabama, then I wonder, I mean, who is being hurt? I think what is being hurt is our awareness of the world and our particular way of looking at the world, which we find incomprehensible when it is different from ours and experienced by other people. And I suppose, in a sense, if I could draw the one theme that someone like me has learned from his own experiences and narrow-mindedness and blindness, is that you... one learns to become much more aware of who one is, what one's assumptions are, and their limitations. Let me give you another example of something. I was in a panel in Washington, gathered together by SNCC last spring, and we were there essentially to document and make public the brutality in Mississippi, which no one needs to be reminded that is concerned with this issue. And this was before last summer when we went to Mississippi, COFO, and went through the state. But there's been an accumulation of this information over a number of years. And we had what were called open public hearings, and there were a group of us. There were some writers and educators and myself, a couple of lawyers. 25 people had been brought up by Bob Moses and others to testify before us. We knew what we were going to hear, but we listened, one after another, children, grown-ups. And then some remarks started being made between us, I wish my child could be like that. I wish he'd talk like that. And it slowly began to dawn on us that we were in a kind of difficult situation because these people who were telling us perfectly horrible things, yet in many ways had a certain kind of spontaneity and a charm and genuine intelligence that made us wonder whether Mississippi could be all that bad to produce people like this. And I know from my experience last summer there with the students from the northern schools, I watched them living in these communities and be slowly becoming aware of the supreme irony of their admiration and affection for the people and vice versa. But then, you see, as they carried it a step further, they had to come to terms with a rather difficult predicament, which is that if they found this about in their relationship with these people, then they couldn't be that hard on Mississippi and its social system and what it does to people. Now, how do you resolve that? Well, I believe that there are some things in this world that you don't resolve because we don't know. We can't resolve every dilemma. But I have some thoughts on it. I started getting interested in this, and I read a book put out a few months ago in England called Prisons. It's a collection of essays by people who had been in prison for one reason or another. These were social scientists predominantly, but also writers, individuals who were describing their experiences. And there was a very haunting story about a man who had been in a concentration camp who described in the context of his life what it meant to be in a concentration camp and how he grew and how terribly important this was for him and for his children, this experience. Now, I'm not here to suggest the value of concentration camps, or for that matter, the social, political, or economic system in the state of Mississippi. But I am here to suggest that we must even be prepared to face the fact that stress and hardship and tyranny don't only destroy people, but can often bring out very fine qualities in people that we don't have as we struggle to get the third car and the other problems and stresses that we have. We have to even be careful about thinking of Mississippi, and which in many ways has a very interesting social system, an agrarian system, a system of closeness between people as well as hate, and a system that I think has in its own peculiar, ironic way produced some very dignified, solid people. Perhaps more so than some of the people I now see in Roxbury, white or Negro. I'm thinking of, we lived in Georgia in a little town outside of Atlanta. There were 100 people in the town. I'd walk out of my house and I'd walk down the street and I wouldn't say hello to anyone because after all I was brought up not to say hello to people that I don't know. And then I found, it occurred to me, that here were Negro and white people in this little town, Cobb County in Georgia, and they were saying hello to one another and talking about the weather. And, okay, we're against the whole caste system, the whole stratification of white versus Negro, but yet there was that real kindness that we don't have because we're of where we're living. I suppose the real challenge is to struggle toward the best parts of that, as well as getting rid of the other. But if that's the problem in the South, it's quite clear the problem in the North that we all have to struggle with is to try to achieve some of the what do you call it, rural 19th century, I accuse myself of being a 19th century romantic agrarian, but nevertheless achieve some of the closeness between people that one sees in some of the sections of this country and doesn't see in other sections. I suppose I could stop now and ask you some questions. I think a lot of white Southerners have gone through an experience unique in current American history, which is the real hard job of looking at one's society and trying to make sense of it in its ambiguity and contradiction and tension, something that I don't see happening in many other parts of this country. Many of these white people that we have got to know, including some real hard-nosed segregationists, have had to stop and think about how does their society run, who is making the changes, how is it occurring, and what are they going to do? And they've had a struggle between, for instance, their belief in law and order and their antipathy to mobs, in many cases, and their wish for segregation. This is a very interesting problem, by the way, again, focusing back on my interest as a psychiatrist, because my fantasy as I got involved in this work was that obviously people that join mobs are disturbed. There must be something wrong with them. They're mentally ill in one way or another. I presented a paper at a psychiatric meeting a couple of years ago, and I was prodded by several people in the audience about, well, those people are psychotic. Well, we've got these words, you see, and we're ready to trigger them off when we're confronted with certain situations. But the point is that they're not psychotic. And the point is they're not mentally ill, and if they are mentally ill, then the term is useless. Because in New Orleans, there were mobs, and in Atlanta, there weren't mobs. Now, is this because they're a collection of free-floating, disturbed people in New Orleans and not in Atlanta? Are the whites in New Orleans especially hateful? And the answer, of course, is that psychiatric explanations in this case are ridiculous. The answer is that the police department and the mayor and the political and economic system in New Orleans established a policy that allowed for and aided and abetted mobs. And in Atlanta, this was not the case, and therefore, mobs didn't form. Mobs can form any place, given a breakdown in the social system. They don't only attract disturbed people. The plasticity of Southern segregationists I can attest to. And I later learned something that I had learned before I ever got involved in this work, which was the following. I worked in this Air Force base for 2 years. On that base were Negro and white corpsmen. This is in the heart of Mississippi. They were sleeping in the same barracks. They were going to the base theater together. They were eating in the hospital cafeteria together. And we had a Negro nurse on our ward who was not only saluted by these white Southern hillbilly redneck types that we hear about, but there was a genuine closeness between her and them simply because she was a very nice person and they liked her. And the whole base was as desegregated as any part of America. They'd leave that base, they'd go into the town of Biloxi, and it was immediately different. Now, we had a president of the United States who said around that time in the late 50s that the only way you can have change is deep in the hearts and minds of people. Now, this is very interesting, because what he's saying is, and there's a certain way that we have in our culture today of thinking that would support this. After all, people have deep-rooted emotional attitudes and prejudices, and they will only change slightly. After all, I have spent years with patients in analysis with them, and I know how difficult it is for them to change in certain regards. So I would naturally assume If that is the case with individual problems, that this would even be more so in something like this. And yet they were changing totally given the desegregated base, and then totally back given the customs in the town of Biloxi, the state of Mississippi, Louisiana. The only conclusion I can draw from this is that laws and a social order can in fact change human behavior quite quickly, almost frighteningly so. Now you will say, but they have other feelings. And I say, yes, they do. But I also know that when you smile, even if you don't feel like smiling, or when you sit beside someone, even though you don't feel like sitting beside the person, that this is a far different cry from not smiling at the person but shouting at him, and not sitting beside him but throwing a stone at them. And it sets in motion a totally different chain of events in one's mind. So I think that what we've seen is a phenomenal situation, namely the very obvious flexibility of millions of American citizens, fellow white people who have been able to make their change. Now, we've also seen Southern politicians do this, and they're doing it more and more these days. Senator Talmadge has received guests at his house that he never would have before. And so I think that we underestimate the enormous resilience of some of our neighbors. Now, of course, the fact that they will scream and say, we don't want to do this, is part of the political game. But I don't think we should underestimate their abilities.
Well, one of the very upsetting, sort of ironic conclusions that one seems to be unable not to make concerning what you said is that the good society, as opposed to the great society, I mean the morally good society, kind society, the loving society, may destroy human character. Would you comment on that?
Well, it's something I've wondered about. My wife sometimes says to me, what are we going to do with our little boy? Are we going to go and send him into punishment in order to make him like some of the children we've met in the South? Well, of course, you can't do that. And you can't go around recommending adversity as some kind of a value in order. But this is the kind of thinking that, in other ways, many people like me, I think, have slipped into in the past. The point is, of course, that our little boy has had a different kind of life than these children in Mississippi, and there's no getting away from that. On the other hand, there are plenty of things for him to do, and there are plenty of things for us to want to do and to set examples for both ourselves and for him that are terribly important, and that perhaps if we get too involved in the rut of trying to, get this to protect ourselves and him from any kind of difficulty, because that being the object of, the whole point is what I feel about even psychotherapy is we're not interested in helping. Our job is not to help people not to have trouble, because trouble is part of life. Everyone's going to have trouble, or if they don't, they've got trouble. And our job is simply... Our job is simply to help people to go out and do things and be something. I don't think we necessarily have to have them the way we are or the way we want them, because I don't think we necessarily have the right kind of life anyways. But I think if they have something that seems to... And I don't think we can divorce ourselves, by the way, from ethical problems, although there has been a period of time when we have, or some of us still cling to that notion. But I don't see how they do, although they've got fast minds. But I think that we've got to constantly struggle with our own values and then the values of other people and try to help them to, and they help us, because patients help doctors more than they sometimes know, toward fulfilling our better life for all of us. I don't think that, I would hope that when Johnson or others talk about the Great Society, they're not simply talking about getting everyone over the $3,000 a year mark, or even the $10,000 a year mark. we have enough people on Park Avenue going to see psychiatrists to, and enough psychiatrists quite willing only to see them to show that there is no inherent virtue in solving the problems of poverty. I worry at times about, well, if we can just get some money into the hands of these people, I'm not so sure that certain sharecroppers and migrants that I know don't have a lot to teach some of the people that are in other sections of this country very well to do with that.
Well, just on one thing, I think, you know, I don't see it the way that you mentioned, I don't think you meant it this way, but that the tyranny creates it. I don't think it's the tyranny that creates it at all. It's the that creates the strength. It's the fact that you can end that tyranny, and you know you can, that creates the strength. And the fact that, you know, I'm not at all perplexed by what these children go through for obvious reasons, but I feel that, you know, from the age of a very young age, say 5, these children in the South, and, you know, places like I was brought up in New Orleans, you know, you're confronted with certain problems that you have to solve at that age. And it's and also what is a part of, you know, I think most lives in that is that even though at that time there was not so much the possibility or you didn't see as clearly, there was always this, you know, in the life of I think the Negro people, this hope and this recognition that this cannot last and that it will come to an end. I think that's what creates the strength, not the fact that there is the tyranny.
Oh, I
but the struggle against that, and I think this is what's creating it also in the minds of the white Southerner, because they also have been shamed by this and also been constricted by it, so that they are beginning to see also the possibility of coming out of it and of changing it.
Although, and this is perhaps something that I should particularly say now, because we're talking about this problem of immigration and the family, what one is struck with in both white and Negro families, this has all happened so suddenly. I remember when SNCC was first forming in Atlanta in 1960, in 5 years to turn on the television set and hear the President of the United States saying, "We shall overcome." You know, it was an incredible experience in 5 years. E.M. Forster collected some of his essays, and he said, under the title of Two Cheers for Democracy, an ironic title. And I thought, you know, when I heard that, I thought, well, 2 1/4 cheers right now to see this happen. And yet, what has happened because of the swift pace of this is that in both cases, parents are absolutely incredulous. They just don't believe it. And, for instance, in many of these families in Atlanta and New Orleans, the parents, although looking for this better day, would not want their children to go through with it. Those students, particularly the older ones, the high school students in Atlanta, had to fight their parents as well as the Atlanta school board, who were not only frightened, but just incredulous and couldn't conceive of this. Just as white families, their children go to school and they come back and tell them this and they just don't believe it. So we have an example of a very swift moving moment in our life and the generational gap between older people and younger people, even if they want their children to be doing this. I'm thinking of many of the sit-in students that I know who have just gone home and their parents have to scratch their heads and say, "Now, how has all this happened? When did it start?" And there was a very fascinating thing in the New Yorker, last week there was a talk of the town, a kind of a discussion with Roy Wilkins. And it reminded me.